2 Samuel 11 and 12, the sixth talk in a series in 2 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on March 15, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. Yeah, 11 and 12. This will be my last week until my next stint, so we'll stop here in 2 Samuel and pick up when I have my next stint. But this is, as I mentioned last week, this is a pivotal section in 2 Samuel. Up until now, we've seen David as an exemplary man of God. He's been very faithful to God. He's been very loyal to Saul in particular, but Saul and Jonathan, not wanting to disrespect their position as Saul is the anointed of God and the king of Israel. And God has blessed David with a lot of success. Things haven't been easy, but clearly God was with him throughout that and helped him through the process. But now in this chapter, we're going to see David act very foolishly. And it is, as we'll see as we go through here, every time I read this chapter, I cringe at every verse. With everything that David does, it gets worse and worse. He acts more and more foolishly as time goes on. So we're seeing a different side of David here than what we've seen up to now. And this passage, and that is chapters 11 and 12, are at the same time one of the most discouraging passages in all of Scripture and one of the most encouraging, and we'll talk about how that can be. The background for this event is David, having become king of all of Israel, has taken seriously the responsibility that was given to the people of Israel to claim the promised land, to claim Canaan as their own, and to drive out the Canaanites. And David has been doing that, and he's been driving out all of the enemies of Israel from Palestine, and has been doing that very successfully, and has moved into the Transjordan area, east of the Jordan River, and has been driving out their enemies there. In the last week, it was the Ammonites. The Ammonites and the Israelites had been on good terms for a period of time, certainly ever since David had become king, and probably even prior to that. But the Ammonite king died. His son became the new king, and David sent a group of emissaries to congratulate the new king and establish good relations with the new king. And the new king decided that these were not goodwill emissaries, these were spies that David had sent. So the new Ammonite king, dishonored these emissaries, shaved off half their beard, cut off half their clothes, and sent them back. David was outraged and went to war against the Ammonites, defeated the Ammonites with an Aramean, with their Aramean allies. So then the Arameans went and got reinforcements because they were afraid Israel was getting too big for its britches. So they went and got their other Aramean allies and united and fought against the Israelites. And once again, the Israelites were successful. So, up to this point in time, the Ammonites have been defeated in the field. The Arameans, their allies, have been defeated. The Ammonites now are holed up in their cities, in their walled cities. And David decides to bring them completely to submission. And that's what's going to happen. That's the context of what's happening in chapter 11. That is to say, the Israelites are taking on the Ammonite cities at this point. Verse 1. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him, and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. Spring is the time for warfare in the ancient Near East. The ground dries out. Once the ground dries out, then you can drive your chariots. Your horses can move more easily. The first crops are reaching maturity, and so you can feed your troops. They didn't use supply lines in the ancient world. The armies ate as they went. So spring was the time to go to battle, and Israel is going to battle this spring. So this is probably 7 months after the events of chapter 10. It says, at the time when kings go out to battle, an interesting thing for the author of 2 Samuel to throw in here. I think what we are to understand from this is David is beginning to act like all the other kings. That's certainly what we're going to see in the rest of this chapter. He's acting much more like the other kings than he has up to now. And I think this is a hint of that transformation that David has gone through. David is staying in Jerusalem, which is unusual. In the wars up to now, David has been intimately involved in the fighting personally. But at this point in time, apparently there are enough administrative duties in Jerusalem that he stays home. He sends Joab out to command the armies. As we'll see later in 2 Samuel, at some point in time, and it's not clear when this happened, David's soldiers insisted that he not come with them into the battlefield, but that he stay back in Jerusalem because they didn't want anything to happen to him. That could have happened before this. It's not clear. In any case, David sends Joab out to besiege Rabbah, which is the capital of the Ammonites. That's where the king of the Ammonites resides. And David stays home. Next section. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And David sent messengers and took her. And when she came to him, he lay with her. And when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, "I am pregnant." So it's the evening, one day in the spring, probably a warm day when the temperatures warm up in Israel. The most pleasant, the most comfortable area, living space in the house is out of the house. It's on top of the house. So he couldn't sleep. Apparently he had tried to sleep. He was in bed, couldn't sleep. He comes up on top of his house and apparently is just looking over the city below him. His palace was in all likelihood on, there's kind of two high points in Jerusalem, and the highest point is where the temple eventually gets built. He was probably on the other one, the next to the highest point. point in Jerusalem. And so he's looking out over the city, and he sees a woman bathing. Now, I wish we had more cultural information with respect to where would she be bathing? What does it mean for her to be bathing? Does this mean that she is completely unclothed, partially unclothed? I don't know the answers to those questions. Would she have been in her house? Would she have been in a courtyard? Would she have been on the roof of the house? None of that is clear. But he sees her and is struck by her beauty. So he wants to know who this woman is. And he asks his servants, who is this woman? And the answer is, this is Bathsheba. She is the daughter of Eliam. Well, Eliam is one of David's fighting men. He had a core army that had been with him throughout his travels. And Eliam would have been one of those. Eliam's father was one of David's key advisors. So Bathsheba is the daughter of Eliam. She's the granddaughter of, and I can't remember who the grandfather's name is, but David's advisors. And then the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Uriah the Hittite is one of David's 30 men, his best fighters. So now David knows who she is, and she has lots of connections with David. David sends messengers to her to bring her back to the palace, to his palace, which happens. She returns with the messengers, and David sleeps with her. And afterwards, it says, and when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. Now, the uncleanness apparently would be, in all likelihood, would have been the period of time after her menstruation. 1 week, she would be unclean until 1 week after the end of menstruation. And apparently this is marking the end of that 1 week period. Then she returns to her house. Apparently then this would be the most likely time for her to be fertile. So particularly bad timing. And she purified herself from her uncleanness is kind of an interesting phrase. Having just committed adultery, to purify yourself from the uncleanness of your menstrual period seems a strange juxtaposition. She did conceive, and as soon as she knew that she had conceived, she sent word to David and told him, "I am pregnant." Now, it's not clear what Bathsheba's part in all of this is. Whether she is acting immodestly, if there's any way in which she has acted immodestly, or whether she is without real guilt here. That's hard to answer. The text doesn't give any clues. I think it is interesting that nowhere in the text as it follows is there any condemnation of Bathsheba in any of this. But there's no praise either. I mean, it's we don't have any clues either way. So I think that my suspicion is that she is not really culpable in this. But in any case, the author has so constructed this that is not an issue. The issue here is David. And the fact is, David is the one who is responsible for his actions, and his actions were atrocious. And you can see things, you start to see this whole domino effect of bad choices that David has made, and the situation keeps getting worse as we progress. And the situation just got worse when he learned that Bathsheba was pregnant. Now he's got a problem. Now there's going to be evidence of what he had done that's going to show up in about 9 months. Next section. Then David sent to Joab, saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked concerning the welfare of Joab and the people and the state of the war. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. Now when they told David, saying, "Uriah did not go down to his house," David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" And Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Stay here today also, and tomorrow I will let you go." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now David called him, and he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his bed with his lord's servants, but he did not go down to his house. So David finds out that Bathsheba's pregnant, and you can just see the wheels churning in David's head. He's thinking, I got to do something pretty fast and pretty significant here. So he comes up with a plan, great plan. He's going to have Uriah the Hittite come back. And if Uriah the Hittite comes back and sleeps with Bathsheba, then no problem. A child will be born, but the paternity of that father, of that child won't be known. And everyone will assume that it was Uriah, and David will be off the hook. So he has Uriah come back, and he asks Uriah, "Well, how are things going in the siege?" And Uriah's got to be thinking, okay, I'm one of the 30, and he's asking me questions that any messenger could have brought him news of. This seems like a bad use of manpower here. But David presses him with these questions on the war, and I'm sure that Uriah fills him in on what's going on. And then David says, "Great, thanks for the information. Now go home and spend the night in your house." And he even sends a present with him, and it's probably food and drink. And says, "Have a great evening, and then you can go back to the war." Uriah won't go home. Now it's not clear exactly why this is, but there are indications that David, when he went out to war, saw that as a holy mission. And in general would have his men stay ritually clean. If you recall when David was fleeing from Saul on short notice. He went to the priests of Nob, and the priests asked David and he wanted food. And the priests asked him if his men were clean. And I think David's response is, "This, we've just come out in a hurry." But apparently it was David's practice that his men, when they were fighting, would keep themselves ritually clean. And so it's possible that that's played into this decision on the part of Uriah, that he's on this holy mission, he needs to stay ritually clean. And as he points out later, he says, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. So as long as the ark of the covenant is in temporary housing, as long as Judah and Israel are not established and settled in their land, then there's still work to be done. And this siege that's being conducted is part of that work. And he's thinking, it would not be right for me to enjoy myself when the soldiers that I was with and have solidarity with are still out in the field fighting. Apparently he's thinking, I still have this holy mission that needs to be accomplished, and I'm not going to interrupt that. David's obviously very disappointed. That isn't what he wanted to hear. So David tries to figure out a way to still accomplish his purposes. So he has Uriah stay another day. And he says, if you'll just stay another day, then the day after that I'll send you off. Well, Uriah stays another day, and Uriah still has not gone home. So David keeps him yet another day. And on this third day, David brings him in and gets him drunk, hoping that this will lower his resolve, and then sends him off. But again, Uriah does not go home. So all of David's attempts to try to get Uriah to sleep with his wife have been unsuccessful. And David must be distraught at this point, because he's not going to be able to accomplish his hiding his deed very easily. Next section. Now it came about in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he had written in the letter saying, place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die. So it was, as Joab kept watch on the city, that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell. And Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and reported to David all the events of the war. And he charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling all the events of the war to your king, and if it happens that the king's wrath rises, and he says to you, why did you go so near to the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaasheth? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Tebez? Why did you go so near the wall? Then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So now David is going to extreme measures to try to cover up what he had done. He has decided, I have no other choice. Uriah has to die. And this is, like I said before, as you read through this, you just keep cringing at the steps that David takes as you go along. I mean, you keep saying, no, don't do that, David. But he has decided that he doesn't want this, what he has done, to become known. And so he's going to go to whatever measures are necessary to keep it secret, to keep it hidden. So he sends a note to Joab, and he sends this note in the hand of Uriah. And the note says, I want you to put Uriah at the front of the lines where it's most dangerous, send him up against the Ammonites, and then withdraw and allow Joab to be stranded and killed by the Ammonites. So this note is put in the hands of Uriah, and he's sent back to Joab to continue fighting on David's behalf. So Joab does exactly what was asked of him. He puts Uriah together with some of the most valiant men of the Israelite army, sends them against the Ammonites, which is interesting because this is really a siege that's taking place. It would really be unnecessary, in all likelihood, unnecessary to send troops against the walls of the city. Joab knows that this would be foolish, but this is what David has asked him to do. So that's what he commands. So Uriah and these valiant men go up against the walls of the city, and the Ammonites shoot arrows, as we'll see later. They shoot arrows from the walls and kill Uriah, and they also kill some other of the valiant men. So Uriah isn't the only casualty here of David's cover-up. There are a number of other valiant soldiers that die in this attempt to cover up David's sin. So Joab sends a messenger back to David to report on what had happened. And obviously Joab's concern is, David's going to say, why did you do such a stupid thing? Why in the middle of a siege did you send valiant men up against the wall where you know they're going to get shot at and killed? And so Joab prepares the messenger and says, if David gets upset about this news, then and he says, why did you do such a stupid thing? Haven't you read Judges? Haven't you read about what it's Ahimelech did, who went up against the walls of the city so close that a woman threw a millstone down from the walls and killed him? So why would you do such a stupid thing? And if that's David's response, then the messenger is supposed to say, and Uriah's dead. That will shut him up. He will realize that this stupid thing was done because that's what he commanded. Next section. So the messenger departed and came and reported to David all that Joab had sent him to tell. And the messenger said to David, the men prevailed against us and came out against us in the field, but we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. Moreover, the archers shot at your servants from the wall. So some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. Then David said to the messenger, thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it, and so encourage him. So the messenger comes and reports to David, and he gives more details than we have heard up to now, in that they got so close to the walls that the archers could shoot from the walls themselves. And as a result, some of David's men died, and Uriah was one of them. Notice that the messenger slips that in before he gets accused of bringing stupid news. David's response is, oh, that's too bad. But you know how wars go. People die. So don't worry, Joab. Just keep it up. Finish up the siege, and I know you can do it. Next section. Now when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. When the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife. Then she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. So news of the death of Uriah reaches back to Jerusalem. Bathsheba is informed of what has happened. She goes into mourning, mourning probably would have been 7 days, a 1 week period. And when the period of mourning is over, David takes Bathsheba as his wife. If you'll recall, he had done a similar thing with respect to Abigail. Abigail's husband had died. Abigail had been very helpful to David's men. And upon the death of Abigail's husband, David then took her as one of his wives, which could be seen as a very generous thing to do. And in that case, I think it genuinely was, because David was providing her protection and care. It was difficult to be a widow in Israelite society. So this could be seen in the same way. I'm sure that people in Jerusalem saw it that way. Isn't that a wonderful thing that David has done, that he has taken Bathsheba, the newly made widow, as his wife? But obviously there is something else going on here. This is all one more desperate attempt on David's part to cover up what he had done. So he takes her as wife, sleeps with her, she conceives, and, well, she'd already conceived before. This is, David must think at this point in time, great, I'm home free. The cover-up is successful. No one will ever need know what had happened. But the last sentence of the chapter, but the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. What David has done here is outrageous. And God has taken note of it. Next section, chapter 12. Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and his children. It would eat of his bread and drink of his cup, and lie in his bosom, and was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger burned greatly against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die, and he must make restitution for the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and had no compassion. So God speaks to Nathan, has Nathan go to David and to tell this story to David. And the story is a story that has to do with justice. It's a story that it's clear where the injustice is, and yet it is not obvious that there's any relationship between this story and David. And yet the same injustice that David has committed is represented in this story. So Nathan, the story that Nathan tells is kind of coming in the back door to appeal to David's conscience. In this story, we've got two men. One is a rich man and one's a poor man. The rich man has more than he needs. The poor man has very little. He has, but he is able to purchase a ewe lamb. He takes that ewe lamb and he treats it like one of his children. And in fact, it grows up with his children. And it is very dear to him. A traveler comes to visit the rich man, and the rich man, as is customary, wants to provide a feast. The hospitality was important in the ancient world. He wants to provide a feast for this traveler, but he doesn't want to use his own resources. He has lots of resources, but he doesn't want to dig into those. So instead, he takes this ewe lamb from the poor man and uses it for the food, for the feast, for the traveler. Obviously, this is outrageous. And David sees it as such. And he says, "As the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. And he must make restitution for the lamb fourfold." Interestingly, in the Old Testament law, if you steal a sheep from someone else, the law requires that you pay fourfold restitution for that sheep. So if you take one, you give four back, which is interesting. David has read the law. And he wants the letter of the law carried out here. He says the man deserves to die, but he must make restitution for the lamb fourfold. David's, I suspect that over this nine-month period of time, Nathan comes to David apparently about 9 months later, because it's at the time when the child is born. And I suspect that David's conscience had, to one degree or another, plagued him those 9 months. And I would guess that this particular story would have aroused his conscience even more. Verse 7. Nathan then said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your care. And I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. Indeed, you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and under the sun." Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, "The Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die." So Nathan went to his house. Obviously, a very dramatic moment. Nathan says, "You know that rich guy? That's you." And David must have melted. I mean, I can only imagine. All of the guilt that's been kind of lingering over the last 9 months would all come rushing forth. Nathan points out that David has been uniquely blessed by God. God anointed him king over all of Israel. He delivered him from the hand of Saul, and Saul was chasing him for years, and God delivered David from that. God also gave, it says, your master's house and your master's wives into your care. That's interesting. We have no There's no indication that David actually took Saul's wives to be his own. We know that Saul had at least one wife and one concubine. We don't know whether David took those or not, but they were all given over to him to have. It was common when one king died, it was not uncommon for another king who came to power to take the wives of the other king. And he says, your master's house. So that's Saul's house was given to David as well. That's interesting because if you remember in the story of Mephibosheth, David wanted to locate Mephibosheth, a descendant of Saul. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, was still living, and he located him. And if you'll recall, David said, I give all of Saul's property to you, to Mephibosheth. So apparently David had taken all the possessions of Saul, all his property. So God is saying, and I gave that over to your care. And I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. All of that is stuff that God had given to David. And God goes on to say, if that wasn't enough, I'd have given you more. So, why did you act so disobediently? Why did you despise the word of the Lord, he says, by doing what you did? Then Nathan says, lists the things that he has done. He makes it a short list. It could have been a longer list. But you struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and you took his wife to be your wife. So, God says, as a result of this, there will be consequences. He says, the sword shall never depart from your house. And I think if we look at the text, I think it's clear that from here on out to the end of 2 Samuel, which is to the end of David's life, there is constant conflict within his household. There are two sons that will rise up in rebellion against him. And there will be other acts of rebellion within his household as well. And he says, I will rise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion. I think it's one of his sons rises up in rebellion against him and has sex with David's wives in public as a way of claiming the position of king, which apparently that was one way that one could make the claim to the throne, was by sleeping with the wives of the king. And he says, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. And that does indeed happen. When God, with irony, God says, you did what you did secretly. I'm going to do this in public so that all of Israel can see it. David's response to this is, it's the first bit of light in this passage. As far as I'm concerned, it's the first time that David does something that's more like the David that we had seen in the earlier part of 2 Samuel and 1 Samuel, for that matter. David says, I have sinned against the Lord. There are no excuses. There's no hesitation. He admits to it very honestly and openly. The response by Nathan, speaking for God, he says, the Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die. And I think what we're to understand from this is that David's eternal destiny is not jeopardized by what he's done. Technically, he's committed adultery. Technically, he would be subject to the death penalty right at this point in time. Nathan could take him out and have him stoned. Uh, But God is waiving that. He's not going to require that that happen. But God goes on to say, because you did this, and because you gave occasion for the enemies of God to blaspheme God by your outrageous act of wickedness, the child that will be born is going to die. Nathan announces that, and then he leaves. Next section. Then the Lord struck the child that Uriah's widow bore to David, so that he was very sick. David therefore inquired of God for the child, and David fasted and went and lay all night on the ground. And the elders of his household stood beside him in order to raise him up from the ground, but he was unwilling and would not eat food with them. Then it happened on the seventh day that the child died. And the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they said, "Behold, while the child was still alive, we spoke to him, and he did not listen to our voice. How then can we tell him that the child is dead, since he might do himself harm?" But when David saw that his servants were whispering together, David perceived that the child was dead. So David said to his servants, "Is the child dead?" And they said, "He is dead." So David arose from the ground, washed, anointed himself, and changed his clothes. And he came into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he came to his own house, and when he requested, they set food before him, and he ate. Then his servants said to him, "What is this thing that you have done? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept, but when the child died, you arose and ate food." And he said, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, 'Who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me, that the child may live. But now he has died. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me.'" So just as Nathan had said, the child soon after birth becomes ill, very ill, and David wants desperately for this child, a son. He wants this son to live. Nathan has just told David, this boy is going to die. And that was news from God. But David, for this period of time that the child is sick but not yet dead, David goes into prayer and fasting. And he begs God to spare the life of this child. The elders of Israel, the servants, everybody, they see David in this state, and they see him so distraught that they try to encourage him just to eat to keep up his strength, but he will not do so. They try to get him to get up, but he will not do so. So they're fearful for his health, fearful that he could do harm to himself, his own health. Then after the 7 days, the child dies. And the servants are afraid to tell David that he's died because he was so distraught when he was sick. They're afraid now he'll just go over the edge. And apparently they're afraid that he'll become suicidal. But David overhears them talking among themselves and senses that it must be the case that the son has now died. So he asks them if that's the case, and they say, yes, the boy did die. At that point, rather than becoming suicidal, David gets up, he washes himself, he anoints himself, he changes his clothes, and then he goes to the house of the Lord and he worships. Then later he returns to his own house, and when he's ready to eat, he tells the servants, and the servants bring him food, and he eats it. And the servants can't make sense of his behavior. He was so distraught when the son was sick, but now that the son is dead, he's snapped out of it. And David explains himself, and he says, well, while my son was sick, I prayed in the off chance that God might change his mind. Even though God had told him that this son was going to die, David's thinking, God has been very gracious to me up to now. Maybe he'll be gracious to me one more time. And so he prays diligently that God will spare the son. But God has determined that this is going to happen, and the son dies. But David is okay with that. David is okay with, he recognizes this God who has been very generous and merciful towards God in the towards David in the past. He recognizes it's the same God, and God will do what is good and just. And so the child dies, and David faces that. He accepts that. David says, "Can I bring him back again?" Now it's clear that God is going to carry out what he had told David through Nathan that he was going to do, and David accepts it. David says, "I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. It's only in death that they'll meet." Verse 24. Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba and went into her and lay with her. And she gave birth to a son, and he named him Solomon. Now the Lord loved him and sent word through Nathan the prophet, and he named him Jedidiah for the Lord's sake. So in the loss of the son, of Bathsheba's son, David comforts his new wife, Bathsheba. He sleeps with her, and she conceived another son, gave birth to him, and she named him Solomon. And as you know, he will become David's successor on the throne. And it says that the Lord loved him, and the Lord gave him another name, Jedidiah, which means beloved of the Lord. It's interesting that God would be so gracious to David and Bathsheba in the wake of all of this that's happened. And the last section. Now Joab fought against Rabbah of the sons of Ammon and captured the royal city. And Joab sent messengers to David and said, "I have fought against Rabbah. I have even captured the city of waters. Now therefore, gather the rest of the people together and camp against the city and capture it, lest I capture the city myself and it be named after me." So David gathered all the people and went to Rabbah, fought against it, and captured it. Then he took the crown of their king from his head, and its weight was a talent of gold, and in it was a precious stone, and it was placed on David's head. And he brought out the spoil of the city in great amounts. He also brought out the people who were in it and set them under saws, sharp iron instruments and iron axes, and made them pass through the brick kiln. And thus he did to all the cities of the sons of Ammon. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. So while this is going on, the siege at Rabbah continues, and Joab sees that the end is approaching, that the city is about to fall. And Joab sends word to David and says, it's going to fall any day now. So David, if you want to claim this victory, if you want to claim the crown of the Ammonites, then you better get over here. So David takes men and he goes to Rabbah. And they fight the final battle that brings the city down. And David then takes the crown that was on the king of the Ammonites, and he puts it on his own head as claiming the kingship for his own. It says it was a talent of gold. I don't remember how many pounds that is, but apparently that is one heavy crown. And one wouldn't want to wear it on a daily basis. So he gets that crown, and they get a lot of spoil from the city, a lot of wealth. And not only do they take this city, but they take the other cities of the Ammonites, and the Ammonites are completely defeated and put under the control of David. Now, it says that in verse 31, last verse, my translation makes it sound like David tortured the people of Rabbah. The problem here is that some of the phrases that are used here are used only here, so it's not clear exactly what they mean. The translations take their cues from the Septuagint, which makes it sound a lot like this, that what happened was that they were tortured. One commentator suggested, and I hope that this is correct, that rather than being tortured, that they were put to work. What it's saying is they were put to work using saws and iron instruments, iron axes, and put to work at the brick kilns. The reason that's significant to me is in the conquest of Palestine, God told the Israelites when they would go into the cities of Canaan that they were to kill all of the inhabitants, man, woman, and child. And in some of the cities, the Israelites did what they were told to do. But in my mind, it's one thing to kill someone. It's another thing to torture them to death. That one is respectful of human life. At least that's the way I draw the lines in my mind. And one is not. And if David has tortured them, I find that troubling. And I wonder what's going on here. But if he has put them to work as servants in the nation of Israel, that's a different matter. But in any case, the text is not clear. We've got expressions here that only occur in this passage in all of the Old Testament. So it's not, we don't know exactly what the Hebrew means. Okay. I said that this passage is one of the most discouraging and one of the most encouraging sections of the Bible. At least that's the way it is for me. The reason that it's discouraging is up until this point, David has been an exemplary man of faith. That he is one that is worthy of our emulation. He understands what God requires. He's been faithful to God. He has acted very nobly throughout his life. But in this instance, he loses his mind. It's a case of temporary insanity, kind of, that overcomes him. And he commits outrageous acts of wickedness. This is discouraging because we're all capable of the same thing. It is so sobering to realize that in the right circumstances, or if it's maybe it's better put, the wrong circumstances, all of us would succumb to the temptation to do outrageous acts of wickedness. That is very sobering to me. It's discouraging, but it is a reminder that we need to be on our guard. We need to keep ourselves faithful. But on the other hand, it's extremely encouraging. Because if David could be forgiven, we can all be forgiven. That what David did was absolutely outrageous. And yet God forgave him and forgave him completely. David is said to be a man after God's own heart. And it even includes the David that did this. And God remains faithful to those that he has made his own, that he will bring us to be righteous people in time. God may not save us from the temporal consequences of our actions. God allowed the temporal consequences of David's actions to play out. And I think that's a gracious thing that he does. I know that in my life, the knowledge that my wicked actions will have consequences has been helpful in deterring me from doing things that I might otherwise have done. So it's a gracious thing that our temporal consequences are not taken away completely. But God does save us from the eternal consequences of those sins, that he is indeed a forgiving God. And it is very heartening to see how David responds when his sinfulness is presented to him, that he recognizes it, admits it fully, and without equivocation. It strikes me as interesting that this story that David lives out, his life story, mirrors the story that the nation of Israel lives out. That Israel was picked out of all the peoples of the world. God picked Israel out and blessed Israel beyond any of the other nations of the world. Made promises to them about their future and what God had in store for them. And yet, in spite of that, the nation of Israel committed outrageous acts of disobedience. But God did not forsake them either. That God was faithful to them. And even though he allowed the temporal consequences to take place in the sense that they were taken away into exile in Babylon, he brought them back and restored them. And they, as I understand it, continue to be God's people, his anointed ones. Okay, question, a little bit of time for questions or comments.
I'm not sure if this is from a teaching I heard a long time ago or if it's something that just comes to my mind. I can't decipher that. But at the beginning where it says in the springs when kings went to war, and then it says David stayed back, is that, could it be suggesting that, you know, David is idle or he's staying back for some other reason than, you know, paperwork in the capital kind of thing?
That he should have gone, that was a mistake, that he didn't go?
Right.
I suppose that that's possible. I'm not inclined to interpret it that way because we know later on, I mentioned there's a verse that says that his men ask him to stay back. We don't know when that happened in the context of that verse. It doesn't indicate when his men told him to do that. But I don't think that him staying back was wrong. I don't think that there's any wrongdoing that should be attached to that. But I think it is true that the way I'm reading this, when it says when kings, this is the time when kings go to war, I think what that's suggesting is David started to act like all other kings. It is true that David is starting to feel comfortable with all of the things that God has given him and is taking those for granted. And I think that's part of the problem that's manifesting itself here, is David is seeing the gifts that God has given him as his inherent specialness, and therefore taking God and all that God requires for granted.
You talk about, you know, cringing as David continues to make these spiraling decisions. And my thoughts are, well, of course, he doesn't want to be found out. I mean, so he goes and does this bad thing. I mean, what should he have done? You know, owned up and stood on the rooftop in front of the whole city and said, I just committed adultery, you know, stone me to death. I mean, I'm not condoning his actions, but they're very natural on one hand.
Sure.
And then, I don't know what the point of that question is, but ultimately, did the real thing I want to know is, I mean, did the nation ever really find out? I mean, it seems like this whole thing just gets covered up, and a few of his servants know, and Bathsheba knows, and Nathan knows, and God knows, but nobody else knows, and David, in the eyes of the nation, gets to go on being this great king, and that almost doesn't seem right. Like, it seems like the natural consequence should have been that the people should know, and I don't know. It just, the thought when you said, you know, well, you're cringing as he continues to make these mistakes. Well, if he had done the right thing, what would the outcome of that have been? You know, I mean, what's the right thing after you sin once, I guess?
Well, after you sin once, the right thing is not to kill people.
Yeah.
To keep it quiet. No, what he does is understandable. That's part of the discouraging part of this passage. I wish it weren't understandable. But to see yourself and you're thinking those same thoughts is very understandable. We would all go through that, and that's discouraging to me. I don't think there's any question but what, having committed adultery, that the best thing, the best course of action for him to do would have been to ask God's forgiveness. Now, whether he makes a public speech before all Israel or whatever, I don't know what the best forum of that would have been. But to face into what he had done sooner rather than later would have been preferable. Uriah wouldn't have had to die, and those other men wouldn't have had to die, and etc. So I don't think there's any question but what it would have been better for him to face into what he had done. What would the outcome of that have been? I don't know. How would the people have responded to that? I don't know. But I don't think that that should be a part of the calculus that determines what he does at that point, because facing into it sooner would have been far better. Now, did everybody know about this? My guess is there were people that knew about this before Nathan came along. And I would guess that word got out in Jerusalem even before Nathan. There's no way that he's going to keep this quiet, keep it a secret from everybody. It's going to leak out. I suspect that after Nathan speaks to him, that it does become public. David even writes a psalm with respect to this. So I'm sure that this becomes public knowledge and the people of Israel know what has happened. And they seem to be willing to forgive him for it. He continues to be the king, respected and solidly in power.
Which, right, I mean, I look at this history of these people, which is one reason I solidly reject the whole notion that these documents were just sort of made up along the way. The idea that the priests took over the country and then they made up some documents to give themselves authority and power, mm-hmm. when clearly these documents show that the priests were corrupt. Mm-hmm. And I mean, why would they do that?
Right.
Why would they say, oh, you should trust us because we have a history of corruption?
Right.
Yeah.
if that's what happened, they did a bad job of doing what they were doing.
I could have forged a better document. And so the idea that during the kingly period, well, then the people in power, you know, invented this history and to legitimize their authority. And I look at Saul going to the priests, and he says, he gets ticked at the priest, says, okay, kill him. And his soldiers won't do it. Says, no, they're priests. So he says, do we have a Gentile here that'll do it for me? And he gets, but then his men just stand by and let it happen. Mm-hmm. And I have a hard time understanding that, why they don't just say, Saul, you're off your rocker, and we're going to kill this guy that you appointed to do this, and we're going to abandon you. Mm-hmm. But they don't.
Right.
And then here's David, who seems to, up to this point in history, been a very loyal, stalwart friend and captain. He would go, I mean, to the ends of the earth to protect his men. Mm-hmm. He would put his own life at risk in battle. He would then go to the son of his defeated former enemy and give him back his father's property. I mean, he was a great guy. Mm-hmm. And so then as soon as his army got large enough and he could just hang around the palace, he throws it all away. He takes the loyalty of these men and uses it against them. He takes his own reputation, which now he knows is based on a falsehood, and he uses it against them. He kills the people that have supported him with their own blood and their own risk. And why don't the people just say, to heck with you. You've abandoned us. We're going to abandon you. Mm-hmm. You've shown that you're not fit to be a king and a ruler. Mm-hmm. And yet they just say, okay, he's king. Mm-hmm. We'll do what he says. I don't get that. I just don't understand that behavior on their part. Any insight?
Well, in this case, I don't think that they did wrong to accept to have David as their king after what he had done here. There is an issue that I've been kind of mulling over in my mind, but it's still in the mull process. But what is a person's character? We are all capable of doing anything. We are all capable of doing the most outrageous of evils. But we come to assume that when we know someone, we assume a certain amount of continuity. We assume that we have seen enough of them that we can predict what they'll do in situation X. And oftentimes that's right. But there are times when they will depart from that pattern and they will do things that we wouldn't have expected that are really outrageous. I think David's character is of such a nature that people see that there is substance to that. There's something good and valuable to his character. And what he does here is an aberration. It's a departure from that character. And they see it as such. As opposed to Saul, where he really took a turn, his character as a whole took a turn. And that character evolved into one that was not trustworthy. So I think that there, and David's recognition of his wrongdoing, I think is very helpful at the end of the passage to see that he recognizes the nature of what he had done, the way that his character as previously established should recognize it, that that was a wicked thing that he had done. So I think they see that as an aberration, and he should be allowed to continue as king. But that question of character, what is a person's character and what can they do? I mean, that's tough.
So more along the lines of observation, I look at Uriah and I see a guy who's pretty much a stand-up character and thinks about his men and acts in a good way. And what happens to him? He gets kicked by the man.
Yep. We need to stop. Sorry. Thanks.